Hello and welcome to another episode of Shock from the Book of Doctors. Sorry, I had to figure out something.
I quit.
I do too. I give up. We'll just sign off here. Dun, 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 dun.
I'm Matt Gerundaisy.
Yeah, and I'm Jim Smith. As you may have suspected from my ham-fisted joke of 20 seconds ago, the subject of today's podcast is Spiral from the Book of Saw, which has to be one of the most cumbersome ways to launch a pseudo-reboot slash long-delayed sequel that I could imagine.
Yeah, it's appalling.
Yeah.
I felt... At first, I was delighted by it. I remained tickled by it for a long time. And now, having cracked open the good book and perused its pages for 90-odd minutes or 2 hours, however long.
Solo from the Book of Star Wars.
All of my mirth has evaporated, or almost all of it. I'm going to try to wring the last of my mirth out of me for the sake of generating listenable content.
Yeah, but now it's spiteful mirth. It's hostile mirth.
Yes.
As opposed to whimsy.
So. Hostile spelled H-O-S-T-E-L.
So, we're not going to explain to you how Saw works.
No, yeah. If you got the hostile reference, then you too are nurturing a dark place in your soul that pines for those halcyon days of the first Bush administration and the renaissance of torture porn and all the discourse about, you know.
I did not read the article, but there was a headline going around where Darren Lynn Bousman, the director of this film, and
many of them from Saw 2 onward, although not all, because there were a shit zillion of them.
Right. I guess like an interviewer invoked the term torture porn, and then he made some crack like, that's so 2008. Like, well, okay, so you're out of date. You know, like, what the fuck? Like, you can't just knock a term that remains accurate because the term's dated. All that means is that you're dated.
Yeah, etch that shit on your tombstone, Darren. This movie could have come out at any point in the last 20 years.
So, the film does follow a pair of cops played by Chris Rock and Max Minghella. Chris Rock is a jaded veteran cop who is not popular in the department because he did not maintain the blue wall of silence.
Mm-hmm.
And his partner's a rookie who he's been burdened with. He's always worked alone ever since he had to turn in his other partner for murdering a civilian, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you know the drill.
This movie is just, you know, you take a Saw movie and then staple every single possible tired cop movie trope to it. That's what Spiral is.
Yeah, it's chock-a-block with cop cliches. And because the Saw movies were already so indebted to Seven, the David Fincher movie, when you make a Saw movie that is also a police procedural, it becomes doubly derivative in a way that really doesn't do the film any favors. I mean, there are stretches of this movie that play like someone dropped their Cliff Notes of Seven in a puddle and then like dried it off and then just
wiped their ass with it
and then adapted what was still legible.
Yeah, that's right.
You got the older black cop who's like a jaded misanthrope with no friends on the force, and then the younger rookie guy who's got a family and he's got something to prove. And this doesn't characterize the whole movie for reasons we'll get into, but it seems to be following those beats pretty closely. Initially, they have would-be philosophical banter about the job and the nature of
what it does to relationships.
Yeah, right. Chaos,
et cetera,
and order,
et cetera.
And yeah,
and it's all, yeah, it just comes out like a soft serve machine, just you know.
They should have used that as one of the torture devices.
just like shove a soft serve nozzle into somebody's nose or something.
Detective, you didn't tip an ice cream truck in 1997, and now it is you who will become soft serve. Live or die, make your choice.
But you see, Matt, you're using Jigsaw's voice.
I know. I'm already doing the movies more favors than it did itself.
And we'll get into what we mean momentarily. Mm-hmm. So, Matt, how about you take it away? I think that's enough preamble.
We open with a fireworks demonstration above a packed city street, and there's a plainclothes policeman who sees a purse snatching, and he takes off after the perp, pursues him into the sewers.
And we immediately know that this is an R-rated horror movie because he drops like four unnecessary F-bombs in the space of 90 seconds.
There are arguments in this movie. The inevitable moment, there's more than one of them, but there's one in particular I'm thinking of. The inevitable moment in this movie where things get too heated in the precinct.
Fuck you. No, fuck you.
Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. It's unbelievable. They're like pit bulls. It's just all they say. It's
either they're pit bulls or they're Pokemon whose Pokemon name is fuck
is
you.
Fuck you. Yeah. Superlative writing.
Fuck. Fuck. Fuck you. Fuck you.
So he's going through this subway tunnel. The cop is, and he comes upon the guy seated in like a folding chair with his back to him, and he goes up, "Freeze, motherfucker! Argh, fuck this, fuck that!" And it's a mannequin.
It's a mannequin torso, specifically. Uh-huh. I mean, with a head on it, but no legs.
And then he is incapacitated. And boy, howdy, this happens a baker's dozen times in this movie, feels like. A pig mask-wearing figure comes up behind him and chloroforms him. And when I say that, you're probably imagining something a little bit more spy games, a little bit stealth, you know, like a tidy little chloroform rag, like over the mouth and the nose.
No, like,
this is like a chloroform towel.
It's a chloroform towel, number one.
And throws it over his entire face.
And it's also... This is one of the many times in this movie where they have the obligatory, and I can't do this sound effect justice, but if you've seen any of these movies, any hyperactive movie trailer from the last 20 years, mm-hmm. etc., it's that like, fucking, you'll probably hear a bunch of it in the break mm-hmm. of this episode, because I'll find it in the trailer and slip it in
you
for
won't
your
have
edification.
To go looking, I bet.
Yeah, but every time somebody gets chloroformed, it goes into jerky fast motion, and we hear that sound effect.
Which is
and
a
that's
staple.
Not the only time we get jerky fast motion or that sound effect. It's just the time it happens most reliably is when somebody gets the chloroform towel.
And that's a staple of the franchise, which Darren is wedded to. If I snapped one day after recording too many episodes of the Shock Doctors podcast and went on a rampage and was going to torture Darren Lynn Bousman, I would do it with a stapler, because that would be my Jigsaw-esque way of assigning retributive something or other. I don't know. I've already...
Incidentally, this is a sound effect that more or less identically shows up in Death of Me, which is the last Darren Lynn Bousman movie we saw and did for the podcast. It's in every one of his movies that I can think of. I don't know. I haven't seen Repo in a long time. I think you have more recently. Maybe you remember.
Yeah. It's
neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm. Cop comes to. He's suspended from the ceiling in a train tunnel. His tongue is attached to this medieval torture device looking thing on a chain. And basically, he is suspended by his tongue, balanced on a rickety chair, and he has to sever his own tongue forcibly, or else he's going to get hit by a speeding train. And we know all this if we couldn't deduce it with our eyes and our ears, because the killer obligingly comes on a TV that he brought
down again,
into the subway tunnels for that express purpose.
And it's not,
"Detective, would you like to play a game?"
Which, again, all the various problems with the primary Saw franchise. Voice, Tobin Bell's voice, effective.
Yeah, it's a foreboding voice. This voice, it
sounds like a lunch lady.
It's like the voice of a DM. That's what it sounded like. It sounded like someone dictating, you know, "Oh, how many feet am I from the kobold?" You know, "Well, detective." It's not quite that dorky, but it's like pitched or auto-tuned in a strange way where it sounds like the voice... You know, and the Saw killers are always kind of magnanimous in this way, but when this voice is applied to it, he really just sounds like a nasally know-it-all. Detective, you know, live or die, make your choice. And there's insufferable puns. It's twofold. That's what makes it really obnoxious. You know, his tongue is going to be severed because he lied on the witness stand a bunch of times. And now it is you who will be railroaded.
Yeah, so there's two bad points.
I was prepared to rip my own tongue out just to be forcibly...
just to throw it at the screen. Get security to drag us out.
Yeah. Forcibly escorted into the lobby. So the guy, all of the kills in this movie try to have it both ways. You got to see them give their pound of flesh, but God forbid any of them get away. You know, we want to see him get splatted like a bug on a windshield, which is exactly what happens. He partially severs his tongue and then, wouldn't you know it, doesn't get away in time. So the train hits him and he's toast. Title drop, Spiral from the Book of Saw.
God damn it.
We meet Chris Rock, real name.
Zeke Banks.
Yeah, Detective Zeke or whatever. And he looks to be involved in a heist. If you've seen the trailer, you know that he's doing some kind of undercover shenanigans. And he's introduced to us via this kind of crusty, dusty, mid-90s Def Jam comic monologue about Forrest Gump for some reason. It ends on a kind of funny punchline where he eventually, you know, he's talking about, Forrest was such a nice guy, war hero, this, that, and the other, and Jenny gave him AIDS. Jenny didn't give him AIDS. Was there a sequel? Did I miss a sequel? Where was Gump 2? It's like, okay, that's kind of funny, but it takes a while to get there, and it's all just shit I've heard before, you know? Where's your A game? This is like subpar by Chris Rock standards. I have a hard time believing that he punched up the script at all.
Yeah, I don't think that was ad-libbed. I think that was like Darren Lynn Bousman sitting down like, I gotta write material for Chris Rock.
Yeah, right.
And this is the best he could do.
So this heist goes off without a hitch. They rob some drug dealers in this Fleabag motel, and then they're fleeing the scene of the crime, and a bunch of cops descend on them. Freeze, motherfucker. Zeke, is that you? And then he's getting chewed out back at the precinct because he did all of this apparently without anybody's go-ahead, which, you know, is pretty comical even by loose canon movie cop standards.
Right. I'm ripping off drug dealers.
Just in my spare time. And his commanding officer, what's her name? Agnes? Not Agnes.
Angie.
Angie. Angie assigns him a rookie partner. I don't need a partner. It's Chris Rock. So I don't need a partner. You know, pitch it up ever so slightly. He does his best in this movie. More on this after the break. He's a little bit difficult to take seriously some of the time, especially because his voice does trend upwards like that when he's getting worked up, you know, which comes from decades of stand-up that are hard to train yourself out of that habit. And I'm sure it just comes naturally to him.
Right.
But he's not exactly Dirty Harry, you know?
Right.
So I don't need a partner. And like it or not, a partner is foisted upon him. Partner's name is William, I think. What else emerges from this scene? He's got issues to do with his father, who was once the chief of police, I think, or the commissioner, or whoever it is that he's reporting to.
The hierarchy is fucked.
Yes.
Like, I think they say he's chief or was chief, and he's talking to Angie, and you know, like, you're head of the department now, but she's a captain, which isn't how it ever works. It doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, for all we know, incidentally, his dad is played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Mm-hmm. And we don't really know this. I mean, I knew he was going to be in this movie. I didn't know who he was playing. We don't know that they're blood relations until he points to a picture on the wall of ex-chief of police Samuel L. Jackson. Lo and behold, it's Samuel L. Jackson hanging there on the wall, which is a pretty funny reveal.
It is. It is pretty good. You know,
but I'm with you. All the depiction of the actual police work in this movie is obviously coming from such a place of blind ignorance that it was giving me like vintage creepypasta flashbacks. It's like how 14-year-olds write police department intrigue and police banter.
Right.
So the new partners are getting to know one another. We get some of that aforementioned would-be philosophical slash kind of Chris Rock stand-up Def Jam light monologuing. And they go down into the tunnels to check out the crime scene. The guy was misidentified as a hobo, but they see on what's left of his wrist the remains of a Fitbit. So they do some police work, try to figure out, oh, the rookie partner spies bits and pieces of a TV set. So they're starting to connect the dots. A USB thumb drive shows up at the precinct that says Play Me on it. Back in the day, this would be a cassette, maybe, or a CD. Now it's just a thumbstick. So they play it, and it's Hello Detective taunting kind of stuff, and there's a spiral graffitied on a wall.
I just want to point out here also that literally every time the villain, because it's not Jigsaw, it's Spiral, I don't know what you call him, doesn't matter, but every time they initiate their speech, it's always like, Detective, I would like to play a game. Every time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, I mean, that was the takeaway line from Jigsaw, but it's not like every time he opened his fucking mouth, the first sentence was, I would like to play a game.
Yeah, I'd be like if the Joker said, why so serious in every single scene. It's insufferable. And they keep calling him like, oh, you reckon this is a Jigsaw copycat? Boy, is it ever. Because he's just cribbing.
It's not a copycat, it's just a photocopy.
Right. It's copycat in the least respectable way. He's just cribbing his classmates' notes. He's got nothing new to bring to the table. So they Chris Rock says, I recognize that wall, the wall that the spiral is graffitied on. They go to the courthouse. There's more breadcrumbs there. They spend a lot of the movie just going where Jigsaw wants them to go, finding what he wants them to find.
Always in these, like, fucking turquoise boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, they find what's-his-name's tongue and his badge. And apparently, this was a buddy of Zeke's. And so, he's like, I want to be lead detective. And he gets in a fight with Angie about it. And here's one of many, like, fuck you, no fuck yous that mm-hmm. he has with other cops. Oh, we glossed over this. At one point, he, like, walks into the bullpen at the precinct, and on his desk is, like, a giant rat trap with a stuffed rat in it.
It looked more like a ferret. Like, it's fucking enormous.
And this all resolves into, okay, well, I was going to put so-and-so in charge of it, but fine, yeah, you can have it.
Yeah, and when he finds out who it was in the tunnel, he goes all in on this, like, I can't remember his name. This is kind of Baz or something?
Boz.
Boz was my friend. Boz was like family to me. We went to ball games together. And it's like, all right, this is news to me. It's like, whoa, slow your roll, Chris Rock. I in the audience, I'm feeling taken aback by your ferocity here. I did not know you knew each other. Also, like all of the villains in this movie, he kind of struck me as a little bit of a scuzzy scumbag. So your crocodile tears are really not coming through. He goes to visit the guy's widow, gets a lead from that, I think, but not really a meaningful one. And then we get our first actual scene with Samuel L. Jackson, where he's not just a picture mounted on the wall. They bump into each other in Chris Rock's apartment, draw guns on each other, as you do in this movie. Every character is a cop, a foul-mouthed cop on the edge. That's how they respond to the slightest stressor. And it turns out that they're both weirdly estranged and also not, because they live in very close proximity to one another. And this could have been funny. Samuel L. Jackson is his landlord, apparently.
Yeah.
And Chris Rock has a good line about how they, you know, we bumped into each other. I don't know about what he said, but like out on the sidewalk the other day, and you nodded at me like I was the other black guy in the supermarket.
The mall, yeah, I think right. It was. The only other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they pay lip service to the idea that, okay, they're going to reconnect. They're going to get dinner at some point. More leads being tracked down, as we've, I think, established, as the movie has exhaustively established at this point. There's a lot of animosity in the police department, and the other cops don't want to kick information up to Chris Rock because he's a rat or a ferret, as the case may be. And
badger.
And so one of them gets a lead to do with who the purse snatcher from the opening scene was, and he goes to track that down and gets Ferris Bueller'd. He like finds a body on a cot. He's like, wake up. so-and-so, and goes to kick it, and it's another just a mannequin.
Pig mask.
Oh, yeah, no, it's right. It's just a pig mask.
With a blanket on it. There's no torso.
Right, like, Ferris tried harder than that, and he was just playing hooky.
Right.
And then what do you know? He gets chloroform toweled from behind. He wakes up in a trap where he gets his fingers ripped off, and then he gets fatally electrocuted again. The movie has it both ways.
It just looks like a series of finger traps.
Like, yeah, like Chinese, right, exactly, like from a prank store.
Like if you just pushed your hand forward a little bit, you ought to be able to slide and get loose.
Well, they don't look tight enough, especially since this trap also hinges on the idea that he's partially submerged and would therefore be slippery.
Right.
So it's just ill thought out. And that's fine because we're, what, like 10 installments deep in this fucking series. But even still, just put the finger traps on a guy who's not in the water and it would be a little bit more plausible. But that's neither here nor there. So they find his body and we get... Chris Rock is afflicted by this strange disorder in this movie wherein he keeps flashing back to events that he didn't witness or only partially witnessed. We get two of them in rapid succession. The first has to do with the fallout from him ratting on this cop who murdered a civilian in cold blood in order to cover his ass.
You know, Not even his own ass, it seems like.
Right.
Like it revolves around, because we see this flashback like four times,
mm-hmm.
and we hear the explanation each time. This person claims to have witnessed like a cop throwing somebody off a building, and you know, I can identify him, officer so-and-so, and this, that, and whatever. So clearly it wasn't Chris Rock's partner who was under scrutiny from the civilian. Otherwise, the civilian would be like, I know what you did.
Right.
And then it would make a little more sense that the guy shot him. But no, he's just like, I'm going to cover up for this other cop who threw a guy off a building. Bam. Okay.
So Chris Rock flashes back to that, and that's fine. He was there for all that. I mean, he didn't hear the exchange in the door because he runs up visibly confused. What happened? The dirty cop has already planted a gun on his victim. Oh, he pulled a gun on me.
The witness pulled a gun on you?
Yeah, we can quote much of this verbatim because we get this flashback so many goddamn times. And then he's flashing back to, he's already taken action. He's already like alerted the media and his dad,
or
Commissioner
Internal Affairs or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, right. Commissioner Samuel Jackson is not thrilled about this because, you know, why didn't you come to me first? You're going to be in a world of shit. Get out of my office. Sends Chris Rock out of his office, and then the flashback continues for several minutes of Samuel L. Jackson haranguing Angie and talking about how they're in a world of pain now, the shit's going to hit the fan, blah, blah, blah. And then shortly thereafter, we got another flashback, and Chris Rock had alluded to this once or twice before, a time that he got shot because none of his colleagues were showing up to his, you know, mayday, mayday, I need support call. Over the radio, everyone just turned the other cheek, and so he got a bullet to the belly for his trouble. And in this flashback, he gets carted off in an ambulance, and again, it plays out
and then
for several minutes after he's gone.
And then we watch Sammy J show up, like, in a rage, and, my son called for backup 3 times in 8 minutes, and none of you fuckers got... The guy who ends up having his fingers pulled off in the present day, he, like... turns away and starts trying to slink away from the captain's rage or whatever. Jackson sees him like, oh, you Fitch, you motherfucker. And then he just like hauls off and throws him against a car and starts punching him and shit.
Him.
And yeah, this is all in Chris Rock's flashback. And he's at least a mile down the road in a fucking ambulance.
Cut back and then like everybody hates Chris style. He'd just been like, at least that's how I imagine it happening.
Right.
That's what my old man would have done, I'm pretty sure.
Good God.
Then that might have been kind of funny. So Chris Rock and his partner go to interrogate this other guy once they get the truth out of the now fingerless dead cop's partner, who fesses up to the fact that they were tracking down leads and not bringing it to him. He picks up where they left off. They have a shootout with a guy in some crack den and get something out of him that I don't really remember.
Just like a likely location
or an address.
I haven't seen him around. He OD'd or something. I don't know.
I think they're still hot on the trail of the purse snatcher, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, the purse snatcher is the meth head.
Uh-huh.
The meth dealer would theoretically know where he is or have an idea.
They get another box. I think this might be the one that they treat as a big deal bomb threat because it shows up at the precinct.
Yeah, somewhere...
It's like the trick in Seven where John Doe sends the FedEx guy with Gwyneth Paltrow's head, except he just does that trick over and over, and there's never anything quite that interesting in the box.
No. Somewhere in this stretch, Chris Rock's partner disappears. He, like, doesn't show up at 9 a.m. for work the next day.
His dad has disappeared at this point, too. He bailed on their dinner plans, and Chris Rock hasn't been able to reach him.
Yeah, and we've seen like one or two one-off scenes of Samuel L. Jackson, you know, investigating spooky, empty buildings by himself.
Right.
Brandishing the gun and poking his head around corners and stuff. But yeah, so this box that they think might be a bomb.
Yeah.
Everybody out!
The latest breadcrumb points them to a butcher, which once was a hobby shop that Chris Rock and Samuel L. Jackson frequented years back. So they go there, and strung up in the back is a skinless corpse, mostly skinless. It's got a tattoo on it belonging to...
Well, no, the tattoo was on the skin that was in the box that they thought had a bomb in.
Right, you are.
In the box, there's a piece of skin with the tattoo with the name Charlie, which is his partner's son's name. It's his partner's tattoo. And also there was like a little hobby paint pot with the name of this place on it, and that's how they ended up there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's this skinless corpse, and they've concluded that it's his partner. So it's going after people closest to him, I guess.
The flashbacks in this movie are all done in the most kind of clumsy way, where you get visual and audio clues bubbling up to the surface at the same time. In this case, it was slightly misleading just because... You know, it's like a shoebox we're dealing with here. So the meat puppet abomination on the inside is pint-sized. You know, it's about the size of a turkey. And so when the flashback played over the soundtrack of his partner going like, oh, yeah, I got a son. I was like, oh, my God, did he skin a baby? And then I realized, oh, no, it's the son's name. It's the dad's skin. Okay, that's
right.
Grizzly, that, obviously, yeah, this movie.
That baby was a badass. It had a tattoo.
Right.
With his own name. It'd be pretty good.
So we get the movie's funniest line when they're looking at the dangling skinless corpse in the back of the hobby shop.
Oh, my God.
The fucking Einstein shows up, the CSI chick, and she says, obviously he was skinned. That sounds like a line from Airplane. That's a Naked Gun-ism if I've ever heard one. And they play it totally straight.
I don't know if you can tell, but this man was skinned. Well, and then they try and, like, half-ass it by tacking on, like, alive. So, like, that's supposed to be the new information.
Oh,
like,
fuck.
Like, you know, it happened to him while he was alive.
I thought that it was going to be one of those lines that I hate. I complained about a line very much like this in our review of Sun not long ago, where the woman has been flayed open and some stand-up comedian cop is like, you think she's dead? You know, okay, you know, obviously he was skinned. I figured there would be a rejoinder like, gee, you think? Or something like that. But that doesn't even happen. It's like even dumber than that.
Obviously he was skinned.
The only G you think is coming from you in the audience. So this is when we get the big brouhaha back at the station. Fuck you! Ah, oh, fuck you! You're lucky he's holding me back! That kind of thing. There's a character that we've pretty much left out of the proceedings. We've talked about him as it pertains to the flashbacks. He's the crooked cop who got put away for a long time because Chris Rock ratted on him.
Yeah, it was his partner.
He has gone to interrogate him at one point in the present day, and he's spearheading an AA meeting in a church, and his life is kind of on the rocks, although he's 18 months sober, so that's not nothing.
Yeah.
And he's a red herring. We didn't bring him up because it's really not worth it. Point is, Chris Rock goes back to the church, doesn't see him there, is leaving the church, and gets chloroform toweled across the face.
Yeah, right. That is how that breaks down. So he wakes up in this, I don't know, fucking H.R. Giger recycling center. Where apparently the way that Darren Lynn Bousman thinks glass bottles are disposed of is that they go through a grinder and then are shot out of a jet engine.
Out of a t-shirt cannon.
And we get another, detective, I would like to play a game. And his partner is strung up. Oh, sorry, I don't want to lie this part. Before Chris Rock realizes he's not alone in the room, he is handcuffed to some water pipes or something.
Uh-huh.
And he sees a saw and he goes to work on the cuffs. And then he like briefly contemplates cutting off his own hand. It's like, do we really have to do this again? Thankfully, no. The one moment of like vague restraint from Bousman is here. Instead, he sees like a bobby pin on the ground and uses the saw to like drag it over to him and pick the cuffs.
Yeah, but like for all my misgivings about the original Saw, that is a kind of iconic horror scenario now, you know, Cary Elwes chained to the pipe in the grimy bathroom. Why even invoke that imagery if you're just going to have Chris Rock extricate himself from it in the most boring way possible? Like, oh, there's a bobby pin. What luck? Gee, right. You know, I don't know. So I'm with you. I'm glad he doesn't hack his hand off, because that would have been just totally been there, done that. But I'm trying to think of what to even liken it to. I mean, I don't know. It'd be like if you made a belated sequel to Seven, and I don't know, the sloth guy had just managed to get out of the bed somehow in the intervening time. It'd be like, oh, what's,
how I see fortunate. You've made a full recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, way to just defang this thing that used to be interesting. Anyway, he comes to, gets the lay of the land, sees his ex-partner, Mr. AA, strung up in the middle of the room in front of the aforementioned glass cannons. And he proceeds to get pelted with shards of broken glass. Happens a couple times on a cycle. There are windows where it's not firing, where Chris Rock has to run up and try to save him. This felt kind of video gamey to me.
Yes.
And
finally he figures out, like, or you can throw away... It's another stupid pun clue. He, like, upends a trash can and finds a key in it. And then he's, like, trying to use the trash can to shield his face from the flying glass.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, unlocks the padlock that's holding his ex-partner in place, but by then he's already been shredded too much and he's dead.
Yeah, wouldn't you know it, Darren has his cake and eats it too. They both...
Again.
They both solve the trap and still die, which isn't very sporting, but whatever.
Yeah, so Chris Rock walks away riddled with glass.
Yeah, you should see the other guy.
So, we dropped the ball here a little bit. Neither of us could remember whether this happened before or after the glass jet engine sequence, but Chris Rock is out looking for his dad, and he gets a call on the radio like, officer down at such and such and such and such, and he goes there, and this cop was attacked by a guy in a pig mask. But then we get another, like, tedious flashback in audio and video just to make sure that we get the point across, and this is shit about, like, while you're trying to figure out which body's going to drop next, I'm going to be coming for your head. And then we also get, you're head of the department now. So immediately Chris Rock, well, not immediately, because there's this whole fucking preamble, but Chris Rock's, Angie! And then he is tear-assing back to the precinct. Meanwhile,
because she's the chief or the commissioner or the captain or whatever the fuck. She's the head of the department. Oh my God.
Meanwhile,
she
has gotten a text purportedly from Marcus Banks, Sammy J, saying, like, go check out cold case file, whatever. So she goes down to the basement, and lo and behold, there's Pigface. And she gets a chloroform towel. And then the whole thing in this is either you press the back of your neck into this blade and sever your spinal cord, which will somehow free you, or you're going to get hot wax all over your face.
And this time there's not even...
Because you talk shit about the movie House of Wax or some nonsense. You know? You
rooted for, I wanted to say Nicole Richie. It's not her. Paris Hilton to die. And that was, you know, poor form. Yeah, no, in this case, there's not even a mechanical causal relationship between her severing her spine and the thing with the wax. I mean, normally it's just you have to sever a body part in order to extricate yourself from the machinery. Here, I guess the killer is just theoretically watching with his hand on the abort lever, waiting to see if she severs her spinal column. I mean, obviously, if she paralyzes herself, she's not walking away. So this one is just, there's just no coming out of this one. And stop me if you heard this one. She gets most of the way through her neck and still gets a face full of wax.
Yeah. And Chris Rock obviously doesn't make it there in time. He, like, gets there, pulls a bunch of wax off, and tries to resuscitate her, and she's very much dead.
Yeah, so all of that nonsense precedes everything at H.R. Giger's glass-smashing emporium.
And so his ex-partner gets killed, and then he walks off into some corridors, picking glass out of his arm and out of his face and shit, and he walks down a few more corridors, and lo and behold, there's his partner, who, as it turns out, was the witness who got shot. It's his kid. And, you know, it's been a whole revenge thing. And we get even more flashbacks.
Yeah, flashbacks. Oh,
this is personal for him and blah, 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 blah.
The witness pulled a gun. Yeah, we get all that for the umpteenth time. Kid saw his dad get shot in the hotel hallway. Not hotel, apartment complex, looks like. And he's been out for revenge. Saw this coming a mile away. You might not have gotten it from our plot rundown, but in the movie, it is couldn't be more apparent that the kid is behind all of this.
Yeah, the fact that you don't see a face on the corpse. Also, apparently they didn't, like, you know, run DNA or anything.
Or dental or anything.
So anytime you don't get, like, fairly incontrovertible proof that, oh yeah, this is the guy who's supposed to be dead, it's probably not him. And in this case, that means, oh, he's clearly the killer. This is a red herring.
Yeah, normally killers in movies do this by burning the corpse to the point where it's not readily identifiable.
Skinned the corpse.
That happens in Red Dragon. It happens in The Grifters, where there's a switcheroo. He took his skin.
Yeah, apparently he skinned the meth head that the cops have been chasing after. And the other thing about this is that the guy playing the meth head and Max Minghella do not have, like, a similar physique.
No.
The meth head, fittingly enough, is much ganglier. Not to say, like, Max Minghella's chubby or anything, but he's, like, he has a healthy physique, not an emaciated one. And so it's, like, if you saw a meth head's corpse, you wouldn't be like, oh, yeah, it's this guy. Look, it's the same musculature, obviously.
Odds are a meth head is probably missing some teeth.
Also
too.
Doesn't have a pristine set of pearly whites. Mm-hmm.
Pristine set of chompers there. That's a tell. But again, this is police work on par with a creepypasta circa 2010 or so.
Yeah.
It's like something out of Sonic.exe.
Squidward's suicide. So, yeah, he goes through his whole villain monologue, obviously, and then says, I want to be your partner, and pitches Chris Rock on this idea, like, you pick out the dirty cops, and then I take care of them, and we scare the rest of the cops into cleaning up their act, and we make this department clean. It's like, okay.
And he's got Samuel L. Jackson. I keep using the word strung up, the phrase strung up, just the law of the land, apparently.
Right. That's
what happens when you're in Jigsaw's clutches. Samuel L. Jackson is strung up with a bunch of IVs coming out of him. He's being drained dry.
Exsanguinated.
Yes. Like a fucking carnival sideshow game. Chris Rock can either shoot a target above his dad's head to release him from the trap, or he can use his last bullet to shoot the murderer. And so it's, are you going to save your dad? Or are you going to bring me to justice kind of thing? You know, a would-be jokery, jigsaw-y moment of truth.
Yeah.
And this monologue goes on and on and on.
Despite the fact that it's, like, front-loaded with, you have 3 minutes before he dies, and then they have to spend at least 5 rambling.
And there's really not that much information that he has to convey either. The flashbacks are just incessant. It's every little bit of foreshadowing, including a couple that were admittedly subtle enough that I didn't pick up on them. Like him just throwaway lines, him saying, like, I've been dreaming about this for 12 years, all that kind of stuff. All of that, it's like getting stung by hornets. Just every little line that planted any kind of a seed whatsoever gets thrown up in your face. And it's like, God above, you know, God forbid that this movie reward a second viewing. I got to get all of it on the first pass. I mean, there's no chance in hell of me revisiting this movie anytime soon or ever, but even still.
But theoretically, they ought to be holding out for that. That ought to be something they would like to happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Chris Rock shoots the target, gets his dad down, chases after Jigsaw, Spiral, whatever, and starts wailing on him. Meanwhile, the cops are showing up, and they're, like, cutting through the door.
In doing so, they sever some wire, which triggers the trap to
re-engage.
Which is just, again, shit or get off the pot, Darren. You know, either he got out of the trap or he didn't. There's a certain ethos to these things that this movie flagrantly disrespects every time, never more so than this time. So the trap, yeah, like reconstitutes itself, and then Samuel L. Jackson is dangling like a marionette from all these IVs, and he's got a shotgun in his hand that I didn't see before. The lights cut out, and he's puppeteered in such a way that he draws the gun on the cops. And they fill him full of lead, and that's distasteful. I'm going to try to remember to talk about that more after the break. The movie's just ending on a real downer here, and you've got the killer taunting Chris Rock as the elevator descends and he escapes. You get
like,
the...
How do we stop an elevator? Chris Rock is just shouting after him, and then, yeah, we cut immediately to credits.
Well, yeah, Chris Rock screams. It's a would-be homage to the ending of the original Saw, except you don't get the game over. But you get the gosh, and then the cut to black as the protagonist screams, having been foiled. I was sort of okay. There's a lot I don't like about the first Saw, but that ending works for me. Nothing works in Spiral from the Book of Saw. More on that after the break.
Get your fucking hands in the air! I ain't gonna say it again, motherfucker!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Hello, Detective Boswick. I want to play a game. The 3 train is arriving in 2 minutes. It is up to you to decide if this will be your final stop. You have taken the witness stand many times and railroaded innocent people with your lies, putting them away in jail. Today, it is you who will be railroaded. You have one chance to live. Tear from your mouth the tongue that has so often been used to lie and to deceive. Take a leap of faith and you will live. Only your weight will rip away your lying tongue and save you. Live or die, make your choice.
And we're back. So, yeah, Matt, why don't you go?
Let's start with this business about the Saw killer trying to off bad cops, or you know, the copycat. That's the other thing. All this through this movie, they talk about, you know, oh, you reckon this is a Jigsaw copycat? Yeah, I do reckon. All the calling cards are there. And, you know, at one point, he's talking to his partner, I think, Chris Rock is, and Minghella is like, you reckon this is one of his copycats, or, you know, one of his, what do they call them, disciples?
Right.
And I just like, God, even they sound bored. This is like, we're so far removed from whatever spark lit this fire in the first place. And I think that Saw has kind of sucked from day one, but that first movie does have some things going for it. It has a lot of garbage in it too that's been polluting the series ever since, like all of the visual baggage of the I've called it Benny Hill bullshit in the past. Yeah, that's that the series has never gotten away from, and Darren Lynn Bousman has just doubled and tripled down on it. The one kind of interesting wrinkle that this movie tries to introduce is the idea that the new killer is targeting cops specifically. Now, Jigsaw always singled out people from all walks of life who had done some wrong that they needed to atone for. I'm sure that he has killed cops at some point. I'm sure he's killed fucking everybody. Airline pilots, loan sharks, you name it. But, you know, we're however many movies deep. It's a double-digit number, I'm pretty sure, at this point, or damn near. You hear a motor in the background. We are not strapped into a torture device. That is someone doing yard work.
The fucking weed whacker. Why in God's name somebody needs to be doing yard work at 8 p.m.? Who knows? It wasn't even that hot today. But anyway, we'll try and work around it. Apologies if it's loud and annoying.
It's sort of the moment for the killer to go after cops. And if anything, this is a side digression that's redundant. This is a side beef that I have with this franchise. I've complained to you about this a few times. Top Gun, the Tony Scott movie, has too many theme songs. Obviously, you've got Danger Zone whenever they're in the air. And then, you know, we also get the Berlin song, Take My Breath Away,
right,
five or six times. But also, incontestably, what's the third one? Is it You've Lost That Loving Feeling?
Yeah.
That also is definitely the movie's like main song, to the point where it's the one that plays over the end credits. So Top Gun has a little bit of identity crisis. I feel the same way about Jigsaw, and I always have. This is also present from day one. He's the puppet. He's the pig. He's 11 different people. You know, he starts out being John Kramer. Is that his name?
Yes.
And then he's all these copycats and disciples. He's just too fucking diffuse for my liking. I can't pin the man down, and it's a problem for me. He's got this spiral symbol, too, which I'd never really associated with him. Maybe it came up in the sequels more, but they lay eyes on it in this movie, and they go, oh, yeah, Jigsaw. I don't care for that at all. The one thing that works, or could have worked a little bit better this time around, is that pig mask, which always just seemed totally arbitrary to me. If he's killing cops, okay, lean into the swinish quality, you know?
Right.
Like, make the pig thing more pronounced. But it's just the mask, and they don't really do anything else to flesh it out beyond that, which I think is a missed opportunity, because it would have been an admittedly very belated opportunity to take something that was a little bit nonsensical in the beginning and make it slightly more apropos, but they don't really. And then all the business with the cop killing is just too convoluted with all the flashbacks and the backstory, which is not labyrinthine. It's just presented in the most fragmentary, again, Tony Scott, but not the Tony Scott of Top Gun, like the Tony Scott of Domino, like that kind of slipshod way. Every corpse that turns up belonged to someone who was a fucking shitheel, you know, so you don't feel sorry for any of them. And, you know, when Chris Rock is talking about, oh, he was like family to me, well, okay. He lied on the witness stand more than anybody else, apparently, and no one's really contesting that, not even Chris Rock when he finds out about it. He's just like, really?
Oh,
damn.
Shit. And I just want to backtrack to something you said a couple minutes ago before we lose the thread on it. When you're talking about how you can't pin Jigsaw down and he's too diffuse, I just want to make it clear to viewers who, for whatever reason, good or bad, might not be terribly familiar with the franchise. He's not diffuse or difficult to pin down in a spooky way. It's
right.
Not like it's not
oh,
one of those
an
where
enigma.
Like, oh, it could be anyone, and that heightens the suspense and the terror. It's not that at all.
No.
It's just like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Yes, which is going to be a kill that emerges in the next movie, I'm sure. All of the anti-cop stuff in this movie is a bit of a jumble, a bit of a muddle, just like everything else that Darren touches with his reverse Midas touch. And the zenith of this would be Samuel L. Jackson's death, which is this kind of wannabe, politically weighty thing where the cops are tricked into killing him because he's this scary silhouette with a gun. I don't even know if they can even discern that he's black under the circumstances. Obviously, they're not meant to know who he is.
Right.
So, but I think that that's supposed to be some kind of oblique commentary that really just left a bad taste in my mouth. I think if you're going to relaunch this franchise, the world is very much ready in 2021 for a really biting movie where a serial killer is often cops and it's morally murky and who's the real monster. I make this sound trite, and it is a little bit, but it didn't have to be as groan-inducing and just straight-up irritating as it is here. I think that as it plays, and I'm not sure if this was the intention, it feels like one of those like kind of like psyop things that you get in blockbusters every once in a while where the villains are eco-terrorists. You know, it's like, we're going to save the environment, but we're going to go too far. You know, that that kind of thing. You know, we're gonna, for some reason, we have to kill a baby in order to blow up this dam or whatever. Or like fucking the villain in Black Panther. Like, I'm going to make some solid points and then just kill a bunch of people because I get a murder hard-on about it, you know? Like that kind of thing. It's like the villain, this goes back to like Professor Xavier and Magneto. This is an old hat observation. Xavier is supposed to be MLK. Magneto is Malcolm X. Malcolm X is always the bad guy in these situations.
Right.
And this feels like an iteration of that rather than an actual, like, meaningful statement of any kind. I probably shouldn't have come into this movie looking for a meaningful statement. And indeed, I don't think I did.
No.
The movie just kind of kept insisting on it so stridently that I had to meet it on its level.
I cannot stress enough how fucking irritating that fucking sound effect is.
As the camera swings around like it's strapped to a fucking horsefly. It's so zippy and just empty-headed. There's just something so grating about it. It really does take me back to the Bush administration in a bad, bad way. Like, I don't care to take that trip down memory lane. You know, it was ugly and stupid then, and it's ugly and stupid now.
Yeah, it's. I'm trying to pin down in what exact way it is ugly. It's like the edgelordiest Marilyn Manson video.
Chris Angel mind freak. Yeah, like, whoa, am I blowing your mind or what? No.
It's like, I'm on the edge. You know?
Try to keep up if you can.
In addition to the sound effect and the zippy camera work, there's a lot of, like, you know, when Chris Rock, at least notionally, finds out that his partner has been killed.
Oh, this was the worst.
He fucking has a bit of a breakdown, and it goes into this, like, quick cutty, again, with this sound effect, and there's a shot of Chris Rock, like, fucking Macaulay Culkining his hands to his face, and like, fuck you!
Yeah.
Get this shit out of movies forever.
Yeah, it'll do that more and more as the movie wears on. You'll get these brief glimpses into Chris Rock's psyche where he'll just be, like, unleashing the beast. And it's always ludicrous. It's always, like, him going, ah. It's like power thirst, I think, is what I'm channeling there.
Yes.
But that's exactly what it's like.
Ah, sports, ah.
Science, energy.
Right up until the end of the movie. It happens, as I said, more and more as the movie goes on. And it's chronically silly.
Fizz bitch and gun.
Yeah, no. Being subjected to that crap was the most painful part of this movie-going experience, including when I put my arm down on the armrest and then lifted it up a minute and a half later, and it came off with a piece of chewing gum. Which I then proceeded to peel off of myself. And dear listener, I lost a couple hairs. And that hurt less than some of the choices that this film made. I don't know what kind of beast, what kind of fucking reprobate leaves their chewing gum
on the top side of the fucking armrest
during a pandemic. It's like, spit that shit, even spit it on the sidewalk even, you know? Just, I'm not even saying dispose of it responsibly. Just don't be a fucking animal. That was more diabolical. I felt like I was in a Saw trap when that happened. I thought that some kind of fucking puppet was going to show up and tell me, you know.
Dr. Shock.
Sorry, Dr. Shock. I'd like to play a game.
I'd like to play a game.
It was gross. The whole movie was gross and kind of physically unpleasant and just flat out unsavory in much that same way. I thought all the marketing, I didn't have high expectations for this movie, knowing what I know of Darren's body of work, but I the trailers made it look more polished and cinematographically competent than most of his other movies, or really any of his other movies that I've seen. But then when you're sitting down, it's just the same old crap. Silliness. Yeah, he's just a fucking not very good director. I mean, I don't just mean the times when he tries to get stylish and his old bad habits come to the fore. I mean just scenes where it'll be a bunch of cops sitting around the office and it'll be cutting between them and the editing rhythms just feel off. It's not shot reverse shot in like a sturdy recognizable way. It'll cut back to Chris Rock, and every time the camera will be in a slightly different place, but not dramatically different enough to make you feel anything. It just feels
it doesn't offer any variety. It just looks sloppy.
Right.
Yeah, it's not giving you a different perspective. You know, it's the angle is not different in a way that really reframes what you're looking at. It's just bad.
Yeah, and if
it's just like they had one setup and then they didn't get enough coverage for the scene and the like, oh fuck, we gotta run a few more lines from about that, just, you know, about where we were. It was
close
fine.
Enough.
Just,
yeah,
rather than well, I guess we gotta shoot the whole thing over again or whatever.
And it starts out promisingly enough with the fireworks and the camera pans down to the crowd and you've got this almost De Palma-esque, you know, the green and red lights kind of suffusing the crowd. And then the thing in the train station is pretty okay, but the moment the thing clamps down on that guy's tongue, the Benny Hill bullshit begins in earnest, and then there's no looking back.
No. Regular listeners, of which I don't think we have any other kind, will know that our threshold, perhaps mine even more so than Matt's, although I think this is largely true of both of us, our threshold for like serial killer police procedurals is set awfully low. We live for that shit, and even like B grade, C grade, even D grade versions of that, we're like pigs in shit. You know, we'll gladly take that.
I gave this movie a lot of shit for the like, oh, do you think it's a copycat thing, and like how boring that is. I have evangelized the movie Copycat on this show more than once.
Yes,
so that should
have.
Give you an indication of how easy I am to please.
Right. So given that, the fact that this movie could not clear that threshold or even like bump into the threshold and maybe stick a finger over the top of it or whatever tortured metaphor you want to use.
Yeah, speaking of torture porn.
Speaks volumes.
Yeah, it's pretty damning.
Yeah. I agree with Matt. The trailer gave me the impression that this movie had a little bit more polish to it. And I thought, based on the trailer, there was like an outside chance that we would get a little bit of that Seven zhuzh to it.
Yes.
And no. Not a bit of it.
Yeah, I thought the casting of Chris Rock was interesting. I wanted to see him play this kind of hard-edged role. He sells it some of the time. It's pretty funny as the movie wears on and he has to wear his serious face more often. He just kind of, he does this almost Eastwood-esque squint that just makes it look like he's trying to remember if he left the oven on. And he, you know, he does the freak out moments, which is the director's fault.
Right.
But all of that doesn't really play. He does okay in the early stretch. I mean, I thought that the imitation Chris Rock monologues that are assigned to him were pretty weak sauce. He has one funny joke about Pilates where, you know, he is, but it comes at the tail end of a long speech. It's like the Gump thing. It's like a lot of preamble to like an okay joke at the end where he's talking about how men and women cheat in different ways. And, you know,
women cheat during the day.
I just found out that Pilates don't even exist. It's like, okay, that's okay. But that comes at the end of a long tracking shot of them talking for upwards of 2 minutes, feels like.
Yeah.
And you just don't buy, I likened it to Seven, which is, I will watch Copycat any day of the week, but I will watch Seven every day of the week. Like that's the high watermark for this genre, of which I am extremely fond. Even likening to that, you don't buy the camaraderie between Chris Rock and his sidekick, his partner, the way you do in Seven, for a lot of reasons, partly because it's just even more tropey this time around. You know, I don't need a partner, all that stuff that Seven somehow made relatively fresh, and this movie totally fumbles the ball on.
Well, and not
but
to
you
mention,
also don't buy it because he's obviously the murderer. So that sabotages it right out of the gate.
Right. Well, and not to mention in Seven, that particular trope of I don't need a partner, I don't think they even, like, hint at that. Like, I think Morgan Freeman is jaded, and he doesn't have a lot of friends in the department, but he's not like, fuck you, I don't need a partner. He's like, oh, hi. Not a lot of people
not like me.
Not
a lot of F-bombs in that movie. Not a lot of grandstanding.
No.
He's just ready to retire. And he does, you know, there is a little bit of, like, typical movie rookie stuff with him telling Arlie Ermey that Brad Pitt is getting in over his head. But it comes from this kind of wizened, world-weary place of, you know, when Morgan Freeman says it, it's invested with such maturity and sadness. You know, it doesn't sound like typical movie cop hothead. We've been giving Matthew Modine shit for his role in The Dark Knight Rises for about a decade now. That's kind of the ne plus ultra of the movie cop written on autopilot. At least as far as I'm concerned. And this movie is just hothead, hothead, hothead. I think he only says that word once or twice in that movie, but it's really been stuck in my craw.
Well,
our
it's
craw.
Fucking...
Joseph Gordon-Levitt will be saying something completely level-headed and reasonable in that movie, and Matthew Modine will be like, somebody get this hothead out of here.
Well, it also didn't help that I remember a very distinct time that Matthew Modine says hothead, and then...
The movie was on the tube, like, just the other week when I was over
The other week,
here.
The last time Matt was over here, and it was a completely different scene, and Matthew Modine was in it, and Hothead came up again. So now I'm just even more convinced that it's all just Hothead,
Talk
Hothead,
about,
Hothead.
Pokemon names.
Right.
Eventually, my memory of Dark Knight Rises will be reduced to just my Bane impression, which I've been polishing for about a decade now.
Hello,
and
Internet.
Matthew Modine Bane saying the word Hothead. Here. Props to the original Saw, by the way. Short of Bane, I think Jigsaw is the next most fun villain to impersonate from the last 20-odd years. Unless you count, like, I don't know, Daniel Plainview as an anti-hero, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's a couple people up there. Obviously, Hannibal Lecter, who's a little more old school. But, like, the Jigsaw voice is fun and memorable. And, Christ, they could not have missed the mark much harder on that one.
Nah.
It really is bad. I feel like we're underselling a little bit how bad it is. I mean, I think people are going to hear the nasally nerd voice that we're putting on and think that we're overselling it. But if anything, in context with all the trappings, the puppet and the music and everyone pulling faces, you know, when they listen to the recordings, it's even more farcical than we're making it sound.
We're giving it more character.
You could say that.
It's even more flavorless.
On the subject of Seven, if you're going to make this a police procedural, I think the obvious direction to take it, and this would fly in the face of what people expect from this franchise, and it might ruffle some feathers. You might upset a couple of gorehounds in the audience, although I think you could still find a way to please them. I would have come at this in a slightly counterintuitive way. If your protagonists are cops, for the love of all that is holy, please just let them stumble upon a crime scene and figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, let them get there after the fact when the body is cold and reverse engineer what the trap must have been based on the state of the corpse. That could be really cool, actually. That could be captivating. I mean, that's how Seven plays out. They find a bunch of wacky crime scenes in that movie, and they have to put the pieces together, literally as well as figuratively. You know, they have to reassemble the sequence of events and reassemble what's left of the victim in some cases. And, you know, can you imagine how much that movie would have sucked if you had Benny Hill-style flashbacks of Kevin Spacey force feeding the guy tomato sauce. You know, like, please, I can't fit anymore. Oh, God. That would make that movie, that would take it from a 10 out of 10 to a 5 out of 10 instantaneously. That's all it would take to, like, completely sabotage an otherwise very, very fine film. You know, like, I was like tittering to myself sitting in the movie theater imagining what that would have looked like. And or the lady who has to carve off her own nose, like, please don't make me do it. Like, give me a break, you know?
Can you imagine Kevin Spacey strapping a razor dildo to that guy?
The actor's name is Leland Orser, and I only know that it's a very memorable name, yes. But I only know it because he makes several appearances in that Bravo countdown that I treat like the gospel.
Right.
The 100 scariest movie moments. That is a much fonder memory of the early 2000s for me, horror media memory, than the Saw franchise.
I mean, sure.
That movie has been with me for a long time, that TV special.
Right.
But yeah, no, he's the guy who's like, he put that thing on me, hyperventilating and so on. Very effective scene. Would not have been improved by Benny Hill antics.
Yeah,
not
watching it play out in real time.
Yeah, or not even real time, sped up.
Right.
And I'm not saying this because I'm squeamish either. I actually want the movie to be more viscerally horrifying than it is. I mean, you see a guy get his fingers ripped off, and you see the lady get her face skin peeled off when Chris Rock takes off the wax mask. But
in the end,
just,
she doesn't really look that bad either.
Yeah, there's like a piece of her cheek that's pretty gnarly, but she's
the rest of her looks fine.
Yeah,
more or less. Yeah, a little scalded.
But in any case, all of these kills are gruesome, to be sure, but they don't actually make my stomach churn the way some of the kills in Seven do, or serial killer movies that are a little more top shelf. When you see Buffalo Bill working on skin in Silence of the Lambs, there's just an anatomical credibility to it, where you just see, like, oh, that's man leather. or even Leatherface, you know, and that movie is fairly grim and gritty, but it's got a certain 70s camp to it, and even that has more kind of tactility than any of the kills here. You know, these movies, the Saw movies, get really up close and personal with the bloodletting, and it's just, if you show, and I know this is such a truism, I hate to even repeat it, but if you show a little less, you really can make it more impactful. Or just showing the same amount of blood, but just contextualized differently. Again, I do have some gorehound instincts. I do like seeing a good bloodbath. I'm not turning away with my nose and my handkerchief here, you know, fretting about violence in media, or, you know, trotting out torture porn. I use the phrase torture porn as a fairly neutral descriptor. It's not like,
right.
I like the first Hostel movie more than my co-host does, more than I think a lot of people do.
More than me by a considerable margin.
Yeah, so those are my bona fides, I guess, if you want them. But yeah, it's just, even if you don't do it for every kill, let them do it for a crime scene. Let them just look at the facts and work through it. That would have been gratifying. It would have made me feel like I was actually assisting in a police investigation rather than just being spoon-fed carnage, which is one of my least favorite things to be spoon-fed. One of my least favorite things to be fed with a spoon.
A spoonful of carnage. Makes the Bowsman go down.
Yeah.
Except it doesn't.
Yeah, in the most...
Never mind.
In the least delightful way. The bodies don't even pile up that fast and furious in this movie. There's only three or four of them.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like a short movie. There's a lot of downtime between victims here. And it's not like a breath of fresh air when a new dirty cop bites the dust. Because as I explained at length, I don't really find these murder set pieces that satisfying to witness the way that they're filmed. But even still, the downtime has nothing going for it either. So I found myself craving fresh meat, even when I didn't find the kills anything special, anything to write home about. The talking head stuff, the plotting, was even less watchable, I found.
Yeah.
And it's probably mainly to do with the fact that the dialogue is so lousy for the most part. They make Well, so, okay, this, we complained about this in our review of The Craft Legacy, I'm pretty sure, how, like, Twilight is not the thing anymore. I don't know why.
They make a Twilight crack in this movie.
They make, pop culture is just frozen in a moment of Stephanie Meyer hate that we've yet to outgrow. And, like, Twilight blows chunks. I'm not, like, trying to rehabilitate Twilight's image. I just feel like a fucking Hunger Games reference would be kind of creaky at this point.
Yeah.
And that was
and that's
the YA
craze
that superseded Twilight.
Like 5 years further ahead, at least.
Uh-huh.
Christ, I don't even know what the thing is now, which I guess makes sense because I'm turning 30 this year. I don't need to be deeply vested in the latest YA craze.
Yeah, and obviously the screenwriters aren't either. And, you know, what, maybe Chris Rock as a character isn't well-versed in these things, but it still just felt hacky, that line. But the worst, they make Samuel L. Jackson say, "What you talking about, Willis?" That's criminal.
God. Yes.
That's a crime.
How...
You should have your
greater than any crime he committed as a dirty cop.
You should have your fingers ripped off before being electrocuted and having hot wax poured on your face
and having your tongue ripped out.
Yes.
And hit by a train.
Not necessarily in that order, although presumably you do have to save the train for last. I'm having flashbacks to fucking Great Mouse Detective here. Or Vincent Price is like, "I decided to use them all," and then the camera zooms out. I just got an axe, a crossbow, and an anvil poised over his nemesis. That's the best Saw movie.
Calling that a Saw movie is a disservice. That was atrocious. You're absolutely right. I heard it. I kind of gawked for a second, and then I just flushed it. I'm like, I can't even process that. I hope this goes down the drain. Hope I don't have to get out the plunger, the mental plunger for this.
I hope it goes down the drain like the key in the first Saw movie, never to be seen again. Spoilers. Yeah, no, I mean, even if everything Chris Rock had said had been as funny as the Pilates joke, it would not have made amends for that blunder. Really, really execrable.
Like, I cannot believe that Samuel L. Jackson read the script, found out he had to say that line, and didn't just say, "Fuck that, I'm not saying that, this is bullshit. I'm a cultural landmark, you can't make me say shit like this."
SLJ is one of those actors who obviously does not mind slumming it periodically. He was famously in Snakes on a Plane, and he was drawn to that script because of its absurdity, not in spite of it.
Right.
But I think that instinct does not... I mean, he hasn't gone full Nick Cage, and I'm sure he never will, but he can be undiscerning at times, and I think that instinct to look ridiculous on purpose does not always serve him well. But you can't always stick that landing. I have some sympathy for that. Still, that line at least should have gotten a bunch of red ink scribbled all over it. Should have been stricken from the script before they ever went in front of the cameras. On the subject of Vincent Price, talking of Great Mouse Detective, I am going to recommend
The Great Mouse Detective.
Well, if you haven't seen The Great Mouse Detective, treat yourself. It's a masterpiece. But no, I'm going to recommend a movie that does the Saw thing and the Seven thing, actually, extremely well, I think. It's largely played for laughs, but it's very near and dear to me. The movie is The Abominable Dr. Fibes. Killer with a gimmick.
Bite her back.
Yeah, that's from the sequel, Dr. Fibes Rises Again, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I believe you're right.
The both are worth watching, but the first one is really a cut above. It's about a killer with a gimmick who commits a string of grisly, improbably convoluted murders. And they're patterned upon the plagues of Egypt, at least in his first outing. So it's a little bit Seven. It's proto-Seven. It's from the early 70s. It's also a little bit Bond villain, the way that they set up some of Vincent Price's gimmickry. It's a little Phantom of the Opera, too. He's got this cloak, and he's got, like, he's mute, largely, and he speaks through this robotic voice box that gives him sort of a Bond villain veneer of eccentricity that I really like. and it's just delightful. Every kill in it just elicits laughter from me. There's one where, you know, because you know, if you, even if you can't rattle off all the plagues off the top of your head, you know, some of the heavy hitters, your frogs and your locusts and so on. And so you have some idea of what some of these kills might look like. But, you know, if when the guy gets attacked by rats, for example, he's not just eaten by rats in like a room somewhere. He's flying a plane and a bunch of rats get into the cockpit somehow and cause him to crash. You know, there's always an additional layer of absurdity that really just sends it out of the park and turns it into a total home run. So Abominable Dr. Fibes, 1971, it's goofy as hell. I'm not gonna touch the best kill. That's the one that's themed around beasts, I think. Was there a plague of just beasts? Nondescript?
I don't know.
It involves a unicorn and a catapult in some capacity. And I shan't say more. Seek it out. It's a grand old time.
I'm going to go in a rather different direction. I'm going to stick with serial killers. I'm going to recommend a film called Citizen X.
Aha.
It is an HBO original from back when they didn't make quite so many of them. It's from 1995. And it follows a detective searching for a serial killer in the Soviet Union. And part of the obstacle is that basically the party line is that serial killers are like a product of Western debauchery. And we don't have serial killers in the Soviet Union. So the detective is kind of hamstrung by this in the course of his investigations.
Because it's an extremely prolific serial killer and they're trying to pin every corpse on a different guy, which just makes a shambles of his whole investigation.
Right. And he tracks these murders for decades. And basically the movie ends around the fall of the Soviet Union and everything kind of unravels. Stephen Ray plays the detective in question, you know, The Crying Game, probably most famously. He has a superior or some kind of military supervisor of some kind, played by Donald Sutherland, who's also very good. And it's just, it's a good time.
I recognized the killer, too. His name escapes me.
Yeah, I can't think of who it is off the top of my head. It has been some time since I saw this movie.
He might be in The Green Mile or maybe Shawshank, one of those Darabont King prison pictures.
Is it Jeffrey DeMunn? I didn't think so. Well, anyway, we'll probably look into this after we stop recording. In any case, Citizen X is a terrific serial killer movie. Obviously, leaps and bounds ahead of Spiral from the Book of Saw.
It is Jeffrey DeMunn.
Wow. Okay, well, I guess I need to watch that movie again. I don't know. Not quite as good as a Seven, say, but it's good stuff, and I would recommend it wholeheartedly, as I am doing, obviously. In any case, I think we've ranted against Darren Lynn Bousman enough for the next 6 months until he pumps out another crap fest that we feel obligated to watch. So, until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Spiral, Saw, 2021 movie, opening scene, uploaded by Lionsgate Movies. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 13th, and we will be discussing Army of the Dead, Zack Snyder's return to the zombie genre. See you then.